Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Vanished ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
There's not a day that goes by that I don't think about him and say a prayer, and I keep asking God, please, somehow, please let me have answers about David. And then I tell myself, well, there must be some reason why I haven't gotten those answers yet. And I know I'm not alone. I'm sure there's a lot of people that say the same thing and go through the same things that I'm going through. But I've told my kids and my husband, I'm never going to give up as long as I'm alive. I'm never going to give up trying to find out what happened to my brother.
Hello and welcome to The Vanished. Tonight I will be discussing the disappearance of 23-year-old David Wagoner. I had the pleasure of speaking to David's sister Diana for this episode. She has never given up the search to find her brother. After speaking with her, I was truly inspired by her dedication. We do not have an exact day or time for when David disappeared because he was living alone in an apartment in Pasadena, Texas at the time. What we do know is that he last spoke to his family on October 9, 1971.
My mother and dad lived in Pasadena when he disappeared. He had only been out of the Marine Corps maybe a year, if that long. And he worked at a company, but he quit his job. It was very boring for David, and he quit his job. But when my mom, she hadn't heard from him for a couple of weeks, so she went over to his apartment. His car was parked at the apartment. We went into the apartment. It was just like he was coming back. There was change on the table, money. There was a box of open shells. Now, when we knew he had a gun, and he used to go target practicing, okay? So the gun was gone. The only thing we could tell that was gone was that and the clothes on his back. And about 2 weeks after she reported him missing, the Pasadena Police Department somehow, and I don't know because I was living in Corpus Christi at the time, but somehow they got in touch with my mother and were told that David's motorcycle was found off of Highway 59 in the woods. So we went. I drove up there. I went with my mom and dad. We met Sheriff Parker. Of course, we believed everything he told us, not knowing what kind of person he was. That's how I was brought up. You believe the authorities. Anyway, he showed us where David's motorcycle was, supposedly, and it was just in the woods where you couldn't see it if you were driving down Highway 59. It was just barely in the woods. And he said a hunter came across it. Well, later on I found out that I believe that's the Sam Houston National Forest. And then I started thinking, what are hunters doing hunting on that? But they do, I found out later, they do get permits to do that.
Sheriff Parker is an important player in this story. He went to prison in the 1980s for running a scheme that targeted men on Highway 59, which is where David's motorcycle was found. This scheme targeted men on motorcycles, hippies, which they called long hairs, minorities, and other specific groups of men. These men were arrested under false charges in order to extort money out of them. Some were even tortured with techniques including waterboarding. We will get into the specifics of Sheriff Parker's crimes in the suspects and theory section of this episode.
Okay, so we believed everything he said, and then around 1983, I was living in Bay City, close to Houston, and on the front page of the Houston Chronicle was the story about Sheriff Parker and his deputies. And, oh, my gosh, you know, it just, you know, at that time, I just couldn't believe it. I thought, oh, my God, don't tell me he did something to David. And, you know, at first we thought maybe David just left, you know, and then I thought, no, he would not do that. And especially, David and I were 16 months. I was 16 months older than him. And we were, we have older sister and an older brother. But it was really David and I growing up together. We were very close. And my husband always said, Diana, David would never do that to you. You know, he would get in touch with you. Anyway, so I called the Pasadena Police Department and told them, you know, because David, there was a detective, David Mulligan, that had worked on my brother's case from the very beginning. And, of course, now he's retired. And he said, you know, Diana, I can't tell you that Sheriff Parker did something or didn't do something. By our investigation I have right now, I have no way of telling you that. It's possible that he did something. Oh, let me tell you. Now, Sheriff Parker, he got 10 years, but I think they released him early because he actually had brain cancer. Some of the other deputies are dead because, you know, they were older than me. You know what I mean? Now, Sheriff Parker's son, Gary, he was in the sheriff's department, and I think he's in prison because I saw an article from one of the newspapers around the Houston area where he lived. He kidnapped a woman. But you know what? He is pure evil as far as I'm concerned.
A journalist, Stephen Sellers, wrote a book about Sheriff Parker. It is called Terror on Highway 59. This book was eventually made into a TV movie.
Steve Sellers, he was a reporter back then when it happened. I found him years ago. I actually talked to him back in the middle 90s. And then I found him recently on Facebook and found out he was a priest. One of the things that I found, there was a guy by the name of Greg McGee. He's in his early 60s. What I could find out, he was in the sheriff's department when all this happened. I think he might have been the one that broke the story. And let me tell you, he is now, he's a lawyer, he's a justice of the peace. That was his title. He's still in that area. Now, let me tell you what happened. This was a couple, well, I can look it up. I've written down everything. I called him. I could not tell you how many times. And left messages, and he would not return my phone call. And then I wrote to him. He would not return my letter. And in it, I said, I know you had nothing to do with my brother's disappearance. But what I'm wanting to know is if you ever heard my brother's name mentioned. And he would not. And, you know, I don't know if he just doesn't want to get involved. The area is still, there's corruption there. You know, there's a protectiveness, even after all these years. So I don't know why, but, you know, I told him, I've been searching, trying to find out what happened to my brother all these years. Would you please help me? And nothing. But you know what? If he doesn't have anything to hide, why, I don't understand why he wouldn't have answered my phone calls or answered my letter. And I wrote several letters to him too. But I called at least half a dozen times and left messages. And like I said, I let him know up front. I knew he had nothing to do with I didn't want him to think I felt like he had something to do with David's disappearance. I let him know that up front because I thought maybe that would encourage him more to answer me, but he never did. I just feel like that he was the one that was the whistleblower. And like I said, it's still, see, years ago, I called the sheriff's department and I was trying to get them to take interest in it. My brother disappeared. Oh, let me tell you, a lady at the sheriff's department, when I said my brother disappeared in that area, and that was when Sheriff Parker was still alive, but he was in prison. She got irate with me. She said, well, I can assure you Sheriff Parker didn't do anything to your brother. Oh, yeah. So there is a protectiveness still in that area. And there's a lot of stuff that goes on. I mean, it's kind of like people in the backwoods. You know what I mean? It's kind of scary, some of the things. And, you know, I read articles where they would find people hit along the highway are dead and no explanation. The whole thing. And then I heard that they threatened some of the people that they stopped and said, if you don't cooperate, you're going to end up in Lake Livingston. You know, who knows what went on? And I wonder, you know, I know for a while the records were sealed because there was a lot of lawsuits that were filed. People that were stopped and everything, they were, you know, so I don't know where all those records are. I don't even know if there is a, you know, if Sheriff Parker did something to David. I don't know if there was ever a record of his motorcycle being found. Nothing. I have no idea.
One thing that I wanted to know was, why would David have been out in that area on Highway 59?
Well, it was about 70 miles northeast of Houston. Like I said, he lived in Pasadena, and the only thing I can think of why he would have even gone out there is to go target practicing, to shoot his gun. We used to do that as kids here when we were in high school and stuff. We grew up here in Rockport, David and I did. And we would go to the high school. They had an area where it was just land out there, and we would go out there and target practice it or shoot at frogs or something like that. But that's what I'm thinking. That's why he drove, because there would have been nowhere in that area that he could have done that. You know what I mean? And then again, it may be he had the gun. He carried it for protection, too. You know, that's another thing. And that he loved riding his motorcycle. He had several accidents. In fact, one was while he was still in the Marine Corps. He came home here to Rockport for a visit. And we don't know yet. We never found out exactly, but right in town, somebody, you know, a lot of people don't watch out for motorcycles, and somebody sideswiped him. And that, at that time, it was not a law. You had to have a helmet, and it threw him 100-something feet. They rushed him to Corpus, to the naval base, because he had head injuries. And they couldn't help him, so they took him to another hospital that had a good neural surgeon. He was in intensive care for quite a while. He had 2 skull fractures. And he was, I can't remember how long he was in intensive care. And then he went back to California. He was stationed in California. And, you know, he had another, I actually was on the motorcycle with him one time. And I came off of the motorcycle. It was in Corpus. And so, I mean, he's had, you know, one time somebody sideswiped him and it broke his collarbone. I'm telling you, I wouldn't have ever gotten back on a motorcycle. But that's how much he loved to ride a motorcycle. So it could be that he was just riding out there in that area. It's really a pretty area because there's lots of pine trees and stuff. When you get close to the Cleveland and Cold Spring area. And it could be that he just had his gun with him for protection. There's so many possibilities.
At one point, David was considered to be a possible victim of one of the worst serial killers in United States history.
See, there was something else going on when my brother disappeared in Pasadena. There was a man by the name of Coral and 2 teenage boys, Henley and Brooks, and they had killed over 20-something kids. That was going on, and that's when the detective, David Mulliken, first came to my mother and dad's house and asked, do you know what your son was wearing, blah, blah, blah. Because what they did is they tortured them. I read the book about it, and I couldn't even read it all. It absolutely made me sick, what they did to those boys. And most of them were teenagers. There was one a little older. But see, Coral-like motorcycles, my brother had a motorcycle, and they lived in that area. So that's what happened there. So when they found all these bodies, they were buried in a boat stall, and they were unearthing the bodies, and those people had poured lime on them and stuff. Okay. You know, they thought that one of them might be David, but they, you know, because of David's age and everything, really, I don't have this feeling that David was one of their victims. I have a feeling more so leaning towards Sheriff Parker stopping my brother and doing something to him. And I know my brother had a gun. I don't know if somebody had tried to do something to him, what he would have done. I don't know. By the way, one of the things I have investigated, the gun has never turned up anywhere. I had the serial number. I have everything. Another thing, I checked his Social Security, his driver's license. If he was still alive, he would have changed his Social Security. There's never been any earnings. It's just like he dropped off the face of the earth.
Diana told me about something that happened that is really, really bizarre. I am not quite sure what to make of it myself.
Something else that happened that was kind of strange, I didn't tell you about this. My mom called me. At that time, they were living in Corpus, and Rick and I were in Bay City. My mom called me and said, Diana, I got a letter from the Salvation Army, and they wanted me to call them. So I did. Back in 1972, probably, 73 is when I heard that the Salvation Army had a missing persons department. So I gave them all the information that I had about David's disappearance. All right. And so she called him, and she talked to this Brigadier Wyatt, and he said that David was alive, but he did not want to get in touch with any of us. And, oh, you can imagine how upset she was. And I said, Mother, I'm going to call up there, you know, and find out more details and stuff like that. So I did. And they said that David was alive. He was in Texas, but he did not want to get in touch with any of us. And they basically... And you have to sign this agreement at the time. If they find the person and that person doesn't want you to know, they are not allowed to tell you. That's an agreement you have to sign. And at least it used to be that way. I don't know if it is now. So I took, all right, you know, it was very hard to accept. And I said, maybe it was when I called. I waited a couple months and it just... I couldn't let it go. I just couldn't accept that David was alive and didn't want to get in touch with us. So I called back up there, and I said, I just can't accept that. I have to have some proof. And I said, my brother used to call my mother. He had a little nickname for her growing up, and only him would know that. And I can't remember. I didn't get to talk to Brigadier Wyatt. I think it was the secretary. She didn't say much, and she said, well, we'll see. We'll try to get in touch with him. Well, time went by, and I called back because I wasn't going to wait any longer. Do you know what? It was Brigadier Wyatt had left there. This was in Dallas, is where their main office was. He had left, and the new person said, and this is what was shocking. He said, I have nothing in my file that would indicate that your brother is alive. I said, what? And he said, no. I said, well, Brigadier Wyatt told us that my brother was alive and he was in Texas and he didn't want to get in touch with any of us. He said, I don't have anything in this file that indicates that. Now, that was just downright weird. You know what I did? This was like maybe I tracked down people. I have it written down. I think this has been at least maybe 7 or 8 years ago. I called up there and I asked where if Brigadier Wyatt was still alive, because I knew at the time he was, you know, fairly old. And they said, no, he's retired. He's in Florida. They actually gave me his phone number. Well, I talked to him, and I didn't think, you know, that a lot of years went by, because that was in the 80s, and then I contacted him in the 2000s, and he did not remember the name David Wayne Wagoner. But I said to, he said to me, Miss Sherbet, I would never have told you that if that was not the truth. That was the weirdest thing. And if they made a mistake, that was an awful mistake. We knew a David Wagoner that lived in Sinton at one time. He had the same last spelling, W-A-G-G-O-N-E-R, as my brother. And he shot his wife and killed her, and he was sent to prison. I don't know. I don't know what could have happened if they found another David Wagoner, Wayne Wagoner, and I don't know. But boy, that is just, it just about killed her. I said, Mother, I just can't believe that David would say that. If he is alive, I just cannot believe it. Nothing was going to convince me of that.
Is it possible that David walked away from his life? Usually when you see someone walk away from their life and start a new one, there's a reason for that, whether it be escaping a bad relationship, or they were caught doing something illegal. I could not find any reason why David would walk away from his life.
No, and David, he never got in any trouble. You know, in school, I mean, he was a good kid. I used to kind of worry about him. He was always in his bedroom reading. He loved science fiction books and stuff like that. And I didn't stay home much. I was always out gallivanting around, and I'd always try to get him to go places with me. And my mom would go, oh, Diana, just leave David alone. He's fine.
One thing that we must discuss is the possibility that David committed suicide. We know he had his gun with him when he disappeared, but we also know that he carried it with him for protection. One frustration that many families of missing men have is that they are often quickly labeled as a suicide. If you remember back to the episode about Damien Sharp, his mother ran into the same problem with law enforcement.
A detective from Pasadena reopened David's case in 1998, and we kept in contact for at least 10 years. I went to see my sister in Pasadena. She lives there. And she's 83 years old now. I went to see her, and I told Detective McQueen I was coming to see my sister, and I would like to meet him because, you know, I wanted to personally meet him and try to help him in any way I could. And then, you know, my sister, not thinking about what she was saying, she said, well, maybe he committed suicide. And, you know, when you mention suicide, a lot of authorities just drop. You know, they think, well, he committed suicide. So he stopped communication, everything after that. And I said, Marlene, first of all, I do not think my brother committed suicide. I will never believe that. First of all, driving 70-something miles to go into a forest to commit suicide. And another thing, he had gone to the Veterans Administration to apply, and it sounded like he was going to go back, maybe go to college. And he never returned. I don't know if you call it a gut feeling. I will never believe that my brother, he had no reason to commit suicide. And, you know, my brother had it. He was 23 years old, almost 24. He had his whole life in front of him. My brother was so smart. When he joined the Marine, he joined the Marine Corps in 66 when he graduated from high school. And he wanted to go to Vietnam. My oldest brother went to Vietnam. In fact, he was over there twice. David wanted to go to Vietnam, and they did not send him. He had something to do with missiles. I mean, He was very, very smart. They just wanted to utilize him in a different way. But the job he had in Houston, it was the job was so boring. And David had a mind that, you know, I could see why he would have quit a job that, you know. And right away my sister said, well, he quit his job, you know, and I could never find out what his plans were. Well, David wasn't a real open, you know, you had to kind of dig things out of him. And two, he would say things just to get your goat, you know, like he said to her, well, I won't be needing one. Well, she took it as him committing suicide. I said, Marlene, and because my sister had not been around him very much, I mean, when she got married, I was 4 years old. My brother was three. So we were never around my sister a lot. And we definitely weren't around my oldest brother hardly at all, because he went into the service in 57 and then he was stationed in places. So we didn't get to see him much. So David just would say things just to get your attention sometimes. You know what I mean? He just had a humor about him. So I didn't take that to heart like my sister did.
Diana has tried so hard to find her brother for all of these years. She has never given up. She has attempted to get some media attention for David and has been repeatedly shot down. Imagine for a moment that your loved one was missing and no one found their disappearance interesting enough to cover. This makes me incredibly angry and is one of the reasons that I started this podcast.
You know, when David first disappeared, I went to the Texas Rangers. I went to the Salvation Army. They have a missing persons department. I did as much as I could. I've really done more since the internet. You know what I mean? And every time Rick and I would move, because he worked for a company that we had to transfer quite often to move up with the company. And every time I moved, I would go to the police department, tell them about my brother, and some of them tried to help me. You know, over the years, they found skeletal remains. I found out about it, and the authorities here in Texas have my DNA. They also have my sister's DNA. And in fact, about maybe 5 years ago, the only way I found out about it, there were skeletal remains that were found in that national forest. And what I do a lot is I type in David Wayne Wagoner quite often on the internet. And that's how I found out about the skeletal remains, because they mentioned David in the article, in the newspaper article. I would not have known a thing about it if I hadn't have typed in his name. And so I called. And they mentioned David and somebody else. Then they did a DNA on me, and I had to wait 6 months before they could identify the skeletal remains, and it was not David. You know, I don't want my brother to be dead, but I just can't believe he's alive, but I want to know what happened to him. You know, one time I called. I have a sister-in-law that's good friends with an FBI agent, and he was here in this area, and this was a couple years ago, and I called him, and he was going to help me, and then he got transferred to Washington, D.C., and he was interested in David, for one thing, because he had been a Marine. I have written to I don't know how many talk shows for 30-something years, you know, and I wrote to Dr. Phil again. And I got an email from them last September, and they were interested in David. I could not believe it when I got an email from her. And she was the one of the associate producers, Carolyn Nelson. So she asked me different questions, and I sent the information right back. I have not heard a word. In fact, I was emailing her periodically saying, you know, can you tell me if something's going on? Because what she did was she turned it over to their research department. Got no answer for the longest time. And then finally she said, well, Ms. Sherbet, I can't tell you anything right now. The research department has it. Then the next email I got from her after I inquired again, which was like 3 months ago, she's on a, what do you call it? An, hiatus, and I'm going until September. So then she gave me a number to call. I called them, left a message. They never called me back. You know, this is what I have come up with. I mean, over the years, I get my hopes up that if I could just get somebody interested that works on cold cases, you know what I mean, that could help investigate this. And, you know, I didn't know it. You know, his motorcycle was found in the woods. Well, that's a national forest. And if I had thought about it at the time, I might have been able to get the FBI because he was found on in a national forest, a government forest. For one thing, there is so much emphasis, which I'm so glad, placed on our military. And you never know, somebody that had been, Marines have this thing. They really, once a Marine, you're always a Marine. They stick together. And somebody that works on cold cases or maybe is able to help will see David. I wish I could get exposure. I watch Fox all the time. And I've even written them. I never got an answer. You know, Unsolved Mysteries, when Unsolved Mysteries was on, I mean, you name it. I've written to governors. And by the way, I wanted to tell you this too. When I talked to Steve Sellers back in 95, that was the first time I talked to him. And I got him and I talked to him on the phone and he told me to get in touch with the Houston Chronicle because he said, Diana, they're an aggressive newspaper. I did. And they did a full page story on David in their Sunday edition of that year. He did get some things wrong. You know, that's why I always go like, you can't always believe everything you read. I kept praying and hoping that somebody would see it, and take interest in it, but nothing came of it. And you know, this is the thing. Back then in 71, like a lot of other people that went missing, unless it was a child, you couldn't get him. I tried to get things on the news about him, on TV, whatever. They wouldn't do it because they figured at that time he was an adult and he left on his own. If he had been a child, it would have been different. But over the years, I have seen that change because now there's more exposure for adult people. And when I, of course, I'm on Facebook, and when I see missing persons, I share them as much as I can because I know the heartache that family is going through. My son was a year old when my brother disappeared, and I have twin daughters 2 years later that never knew him. And Tracy, the one that lives in Victoria, she has tried to help me. And her heart just, she's talked to her kids about my brother. And, you know, it does, it trickles down through the whole family. And there is no, I never understood what people went through that had missing people in their family until I went through it. And I think most people are like that. They don't really understand what it's like not knowing. I mean, I know my brother is probably dead, but you know what? If I find out and he's dead and then I know where he's at, I can have a memorial. One time years ago, Tracy said, Mom, why don't you have a memorial for him? I said, I can't do that because I don't know for sure he's dead. But I did tell him, you know, I'm almost 70. I'll be 70 next month. And I did tell my kids and I told my husband that if something happened to me and that when my funeral, I want something done for my brother at that time. Yeah, I know that sounds, but that's how I feel. I just, and my mom and dad, both of them died not knowing where their youngest child was. And my mom just got where she couldn't even, she really didn't even talk about David anymore because it hurt so much. There's not a day goes by. I have my brother's picture on the wall. I have several, in fact. One in his Marine uniform and another one we're sitting next to each other as children. We all, for a long time, looked like we could have been twins because we were the same height, you know. And there's not a day that goes by that I don't think about him and say a prayer. And I keep asking God, please, somehow, please let me have answers about David. And then I tell myself, well, there must be some reason why I haven't gotten those answers yet. So, and I know I'm not alone. I'm sure there's a lot of people that say the same thing and go through the same things that I'm going through. But I've told my kids and my husband, I'm never going to give up as long as I'm alive. I'm never going to give up trying to find out what happened to my brother.
We all know there are things in life that you have to compromise on, but when it comes to your health, there's no compromise. So don't settle for that one doctor that isn't really addressing your needs. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable. And you can even search by location, availability, and insurance. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. Once you find the doc you want, you can book them immediately. You can filter specifically for ones who take your insurance, are located near you, and treat basically any condition you're searching for. The typical wait time to see a doctor booked on ZocDoc is between just 24 and 72 hours. That's it. I use this and you should too. Go to ZocDoc.com/vanished and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/vanished. ZocDoc.com/vanished. This message is sponsored by Greenlight. When you're a parent, you'll have your fair share of big talks with your kids. One of those big talks should involve money, and Greenlight can help with that. Greenlight is a debit card and money app for families. You can send your kids instant money transfers, get real-time notifications of spending, manage chores, and automate allowance. I've been using Greenlight with my older two kids for years. One thing that I love about it is that I can set up recurring or one-time chores, customized to my family's needs, and then my kids earn an allowance to reward them for a job well done. Not only does it motivate them to actually get the chores done, but it also teaches them a bit about financial literacy and independence. They're learning to earn, save, and spend wisely. So stop putting off the money talk and start putting your kids on the right path. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free at greenlight.com/vanished. That's greenlight.com/vanished to try Greenlight for free. One more time, that's greenlight.com/vanished. I had Phil from History Personified help me out with this episode. We had been wanting to collaborate on an older case, and I thought this one was perfect. I assigned him the research on Sheriff Parker and Dean Coral.
Hi, my name is Phil Lanides. I am the host of History Personified. And when Marissa, the host of the Vanished podcast, which is one of my favorite shows, reached out with the idea of collaborating, we'd been talking previously, but when she came up with the idea, I was really intrigued and excited and jumped at the chance. And so my responsibility on this episode for the David Wagner case was to look into some of the possible theories around what might have happened to David. And so that's what I'm going to share with you. The first theory that I want to look at is one around a man named Sheriff James Humpy Parker. And this is pretty amazing. The story is pretty astonishing that there's not been more written about, or, you know, we haven't seen more true crime documentaries or shows feature this story. It's pretty amazing. But Parker was the San Jacinto County Sheriff down in Texas from 1969 until 1983. And in researching this, I read part of a book by a man named Thad Sitton. And the book is called The Texas Sheriff, Lord of the County Line. And it wasn't about Parker, but he is mentioned in part of the book. And so Sitton goes into his story, and so I'm going to share some of that with you now. But Sitton says that Parker devised a scheme to both line his pockets and help out the rural and very poor San Jacinto County. And what it was basically a modernized version of an old scheme. But what they would do is Parker and his cohorts would trump up charges against motorists that were passing through, usually on Highway 59, pull them over, and then extort them for money and valuables in order to get out of what they'd been pulled over for. So they'd, you know, face fines and things of that nature. And according to Sitton, quote, many San Jacinto County public officials and citizens became involved in the sheriff's operations, end quote. Now, Parker had five regular deputies, one of which was his son, Gary, who I'll talk about a little bit later on, as well as a number of, quote, reserve deputies. Sitton claims that they were all likely involved with the scheme. He also wrote, quote, in accordance with Humpy's instructions, their profile for stopping and searching cars included out-of-county and out-of-state license plates, youths at the wheel, long-haired males and males wearing headbands, multiple young people in the car, blacks or other minorities in the car, vans, old cars, and vehicles with Rock Station bumper stickers, especially Houston's K101, end quote. Again, they'd be pulled over on these trumped up charges, and then the process would commence. And about that process, Sitton wrote, quote, victims later said they'd been frightened, abused, humiliated, sexually molested, and falsely accused with drugs sometimes planted by searchers, end quote. And after being harassed, they'd have to come up with money or valuables, and usually no records were kept. And sometimes the victims, they would, when once they were released, once they'd paid their fine, they would reach their car in the parking lot and find that a taillight had been kicked in, oftentimes with the plastic or glass or metal, right underneath the obvious place where the car had been kicked or struck. And they would do that in order for the charge to be able to be substantiated. And it was quite lucrative. Parker and his deputies would process as many as 50 vehicles in one night. And I read in a couple estimates of a couple $100,000 in tax revenue, or basically revenue from the fines, being brought into the county. And obviously there's no records of how much money Parker and his deputies were able to grab as well. Now, eventually the FBI got word of what was going on, and they set up an office in town in order to investigate. However, and I don't know whose decision this was, but the office was right across the street from the sheriff's office, which was glass-fronted. So anybody going into the FBI offices could be seen from the sheriff's office, which, as you can imagine, was quite a deterrent. And former San Jacinto County Deputy Greg McGee put it this way. He said, quote, the feeling was that if you walked through that door, you would be signing your death warrant, end quote. This FBI soon dropped the case and left town. However, things began to fall apart for the sheriff and the deputies in 1982 when the media began to investigate and get involved. Eventually, the FBI came back, and the Texas Rangers also got involved and began to meet with citizens privately, which obviously produced a lot more testimony and evidence. And eventually, even one of the deputies agreed to testify against Parker, and he or she was an unnamed deputy. Now, in March of 1983, Parker pled guilty to charges that he tortured prisoners, including what amounts to what we would call waterboarding of at least 15 prisoners, and that many of them were subjected, specifically blacks, women, and rock music fans, to strip searches on Highway 59, and that Parker also demanded kickbacks from a local bail bondsman. Now, regarding, again, the term waterboarding didn't really exist at that time, but regarding what we would term as waterboarding, Assistant U.S. Attorney Scott Woodward said at that time, quote, on the water tortures, that was reserved for many for major felonies where they could not solve the crime, but they had a suspect. They'd bring them in and torture them until they got a confession and then take that evidence to the prosecutor, end quote. Now, this seems to indicate that they were using these torture methods not just in pulling people over, but in the course of, you know, other criminal investigations. Woodward also said, quote, this water torture generally included the placement of a towel over the nose and mouth of prisoners and the pouring of water into the towel until the prisoner began to move, jerk, or otherwise indicate that he was suffocating and or drowning, end quote. Obviously, just sounds very torturous. I mean, it sounds like a terrible experience, horrible, nothing that anybody would want to go through. But that's what Parker and his deputies were apparently doing, and Parker pled guilty to it. Now, Parker and his deputies would sometimes, again, they would do whatever it took to make sure that the original traffic stop was legitimate, whether it was, you know, damaging taillights or other equipment on vehicles, and that came back to bite them. Now, Parker's case was presented before Judge Gabrielle McDonald, who I was told by a local reporter from that time was the only black female federal judge in the U.S. Southern District at that time. And Parker had been facing 40 years, but through a plea bargain, he was originally given a 3-year prison sentence. However, Judge McDonald refused to accept that plea, saying it was too lenient, and a jury later gave Parker a 10-year sentence. He also later pled guilty to another charge, and that was violating the civil rights of some of his victims, and he got another 5 years. Now, here's where the math doesn't really make sense. I read that he served about 5 years in prison and then was released to return home with brain cancer, and then he passed away in 1999. However, if he was sentenced in 1983 and only served 5 years, it just doesn't really make sense. He went home and had brain cancer for, you know, 8 years or 11 years, something like that. That just, again, doesn't really make sense. However, what might have happened, he might have only served 5 years and then been paroled and then got brain cancer later on and passed away. But again, he has since died, as have most of his deputies, and there's just very, very little information out there on all this. Now, in 2007 or 2008, I saw conflicting articles. Parker's son, Gary, was indicted on a number of charges related to violent robberies that he allegedly perpetrated. I couldn't even find articles on whether or not he was actually convicted and served time. But regardless, you know, doesn't reflect well on the family. Now, San Jacinto County, looking at it again from a historical perspective, is a rather small area, around 20,000 people. And it has faced a lot of controversy even since Parker was put away. The ACLU won a judgment against San Jacinto County for 4 of the victims of Parker. And then fast forwarding into the early 2000s, there was more corruption that was uncovered related to county officials. And indictments, accusations, lawsuits, they all started flying. And the county is still dealing with it. And so are many of the victims. We found posts online that had to do with victims saying that their records had caused them to be fired from jobs. So these illegitimate arrests had been fired from their jobs. And so they're still trying to put the pieces back together, never mind you know, what I'm sure was difficult mental, and maybe even physical consequences that they had to deal with. So again, very difficult. And of course, another byproduct of this, a result, would be distrust of local law enforcement and government in San Jacinto County. Obviously, that's been rampant since Parker's crimes came to light. Now, I mentioned Deputy Greg McGee earlier. He was quoted in Sitton's book. He stayed in San Jacinto County. Eventually, I heard he became a lawyer, at least saw that he became or read that he became a justice of the peace there. Now, I mentioned earlier that one of Parker's deputies turned on him, agreed to testify. That deputy has never been named, but since McGee was quoted in Sitton's book, since he stayed in the county, he was not charged with anything, it stands to reason, because again, this was not a huge sheriff's force, it stands to reason that he was likely the whistleblower, he's likely the person that turned Parker in. Now, McGee told the UPI, quote, "I really didn't know what to think. It worried me. I knew this wasn't something that was supposed to be going on. It was a frightening ordeal," end quote. He's the only deputy that I found any quotes from, so it's likely that he's the one that turned in Parker. Now, on a side note, in 2006, the San Jacinto County Sheriff's Office, which this is the same office that Parker worked for, arrested Teresa Soap on 92 counts of tampering with government records and 1 count of felony theft after Justice of the Peace Greg McGee came to the sheriff's office with concerns about her activities. So, again, more controversy. McGee is linked to it, although, you know, not the subject of it or anything like that, but just more controversy in San Jacinto County. Now, Steve Sellers, who's a former investigative reporter who's now a priest, wrote a book, Terror on 59, that detailed Parker's actions. He intimates that things went beyond simply torture and extortion, and this is the only place where I saw any indication clear indication that there may have been murder involved in this. And Sellers said in his book that some victims said that they were blindfolded and put in a boat on a nearby lake, and that the deputies would tell them that if they didn't confess, they'd be tossed into the water, quote, just like all the others that nobody will ever find again, end quote. And again, that's according to Sellers. Another quote from the book, quote, most baffling were a series of a half dozen unexplained deaths of young men in the county, end quote. Sellers says that the bodies would show up on some out-of-the-way farm road somewhere in the county late at night when an unsuspecting motorist would run over them. The quote, the men all appeared to have been dead before they came to be on the highway, end quote, and, quote, none of those deaths were explained and no one was ever charged. So, and apparently, again, according to Sellers, Parker claimed during the investigation that these were drug-related deaths, but Parker and his deputies, no one was ever charged. And then to wrap this up on Parker, one article that we found stated, quote, you can't help but wonder if maybe some of the men did end up in the water and drowned and will be forever a missing person, which might account for missing people in that area during that period of time, like David Wagner, end quote. And I'll come back to Parker momentarily. The other theory that I found that was actually mentioned to the family was Dean Corll. And Dean Corll was one of the worst serial killers in American history. You can look him up. I caution you to use discretion when you do that. What he did was just horrible, the things that he did. And he was nicknamed the Candyman and the Pied Piper because his family ran a candy business, which he worked at. And early on in his quote-unquote career, he used candy to lure young boys. And generally, his process for procuring victims was this. He would use a couple of young men, and it was basically the same young men, but he would use them. He had basically groomed them to be kind of recruiters for him. And he would pay them a couple hundred bucks to bring him a young man. And he would use booze and drugs to get the youngster to either trust him or just simply incapacitate him. He would then tie the boy up to his so-called torture board and then would torture, rape, and then either strangle or shoot them before burying the body in one of several places that he regularly used for that purpose. Now, Corll has at least 28 victims attributed to him, but he probably killed more. And his crime spree took place from September of 1970 until August of 1973. And just to tie up the story on Corll, in August of 73, Corll was shot and killed by one of his recruiters who had basically finally had enough. And Corll was preparing to attack another young boy. There was actually several youths there at that time, and the recruiter knew them and just finally got fed up and shot and killed Corll in a very graphic manner. Again, these stories are online. You can read them, but I caution you that they're quite graphic. But just in kind of in conclusion, let's look at both Parker and Corll as possible theories or perpetrators for what happened to David. Now, it seems very, very highly unlikely that David Wagner was a victim of Dean Corll's. He just doesn't fit the profile for Corll's victims. Corll's oldest known victim was 20 years old. They were between the ages of 13 and 20. He liked young boys. He was a pedophile. David Wagner was 23 years old. He looked like a man. He had, had been in the Marines for several years. So it just doesn't seem likely. Yes, Corll was very familiar with Pasadena, Texas. He lived there, and he was not too far from that area. Corll was also active when Wagner disappeared. But again, Wagner is several years older than Corll's oldest known victim. All of Corll's known victims have been located and ID'd, except one who they know he's been ID'd. They just don't know where the body is. So again, it just really seems unlikely that Wagner fell victim to Corll. Looking at Sheriff Parker, if Wagner did not simply run away, the most realistic known possibility is that Wagner fell victim to Parker. However, outside of Sellers' book, I could not find any concrete references to Parker, any of Parker's victims actually being murdered. I didn't even really see rumors mentioned. And so again, that seems to be a stretch outside of Sellers. There's just nothing to indicate that anybody died. None of the articles I read mentioned Parker saying, having to answer for, deaths that were associated with what they did. So it seems to be the most realistic known possibility in that, you know, he's obviously in the area and all that. But it's by no means is it a sure thing. And then, of course, there's also the unknown that Wagner may have been kidnapped and murdered by an unknown subject. The bottom line is that we just simply do not know. And hopefully the answer will come at some point. But as of now, Wagner remains a missing person, and it's going to stay that way until some new evidence comes to light.
I gave Phil a call so we could discuss our final thoughts on the case. So when we started discussing working on a case together, this one came to mind because I had been wanting to cover it. I had been conversing with Diana on Facebook, and I thought it was of historical significance because of the police corruption and also the fact that I had never heard about it. I was shocked.
Yeah, and that is something that jumped out at me too when you presented this this opportunity to me. I was just, the historical significance of, you know, a very small county down in Texas that I had heard of, but hadn't heard of, you know, this level of police corruption. The fact that there's so little out there about it really intrigued me. And I thought it was looking at a piece of history that, just hasn't gotten enough attention. So shining the light on that, I thought was important. During the course of researching all this, obviously we uncovered some theories, and it was something that both you and I had looked at. You know, I mentioned that the theories that I could find and that you had some of that you had shared with me, you know, this Sheriff Parker theory that he was involved. I mean, my personal opinion is that that is the most likely theory that would be possibly true. But at the same time, you know, really outside of one source, there's no other sources that really suggest that murder was involved in Parker's activities. And so that makes it not as seem as likely to me, but it's much more likely than the Dean Coral theory because of a variety of reasons, including the fact that David was 3 years older than Coral's oldest victim. There's nothing to suggest that Coral was, you know, watching Highway 59 for victims, even though he was in close proximity to that area. The police have really investigated that crime, and there has been a fair amount of attention on the crimes of Coral. So it just doesn't seem to be a fit to me. It doesn't feel like a fit to me. I'm not a professional investigator, but it just doesn't seem to fit. So I would think it would have to be either Sheriff Parker or one of his deputies, or just we just don't know. And those are really the only options that I see. What I presented and what you came across, I mean, what did you think?
Well, I agree with you. I think the Coral connection is probably – I think at the time when they found all of those bodies that they probably had to look at every missing person or missing male in that area who could have possibly fit into his profile.
Right.
I think that's where that originated from. And I don't think that it holds much weight, but it's interesting in itself. When you look into him, there's a lot of information on him out there.
Yes.
Very disturbing. I think the Sheriff Parker aspect is also most likely because his motorcycle was found there, but at the same time, it could be something else entirely. And then there's the other two theories out there that he committed suicide. Who drives 70 miles to pull their motorcycle into the woods and then walks a far enough distance that their body is never found? It's possible. I don't necessarily think that's what happened personally. And then there's the other one that he walked away, which has that weird phone call that her mother got that she mentioned.
Right.
Which is one of the most bizarre things. And you could come up with theories around that phone call about why that was ever made. You know, did someone contact them claiming to be him because they had something to do with his disappearance? You just don't know.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a mystery within a mystery.
honestly, out of the theories that I looked into, and the Salvation Army Brigadier General one that you discussed with her, that one actually, I don't say it's the most likely, but it points to some sort of foul play in my mind, that if somebody made that call, either impersonating him or something, I mean, that's a misdirect. That's somebody trying to push in a different direction. And I mean, the sister is adamant about, him not being suicidal or, you know, looking to run away from anything. But it just doesn't seem like that would be the case. So to me, the most likely thing would be some form of foul play. Unfortunately, that doesn't, you know, doesn't tell us where the body is. It doesn't tell us who did it. It doesn't bring any sort of closure, because it's still just that, a theory. And until some further evidence is uncovered or somebody comes forward, it's going to stay, you know, it's going to stay a theory. It's going to stay an unsolved, an unsolved mystery, an unsolved case.
Yeah. And I was really impressed with her dedication to finding her brother. While I was editing the interview with her today, I got to thinking, I heard her say that she doesn't know if there's any records about even his motorcycle being found. And it dawned on me, I wondered if she had ever submitted any FOIA requests, which would be Freedom of Information Act. And so I messaged her and she hasn't. So I sent her instructions on how to do that. Hopefully she will get some more information out of doing that. And I told her she should send those to every single agency that's looked into this.
Absolutely. That's not something that I was aware that civilians could even really do. I know that journalists can, which I guess, you know, that's not like a, you don't carry like a badge as a journalist. So I guess civilians would be able to do that. And who knows what that could uncover. But again, that's part of the problem too, is that there was so much corruption in San Jacinto County from that time, that it's hard to even, you know, who knows? I mean, who knows what kind of information was actually recorded. I mean, you have the taint of corruption on that office. Almost all of the deputies, you know, from that time period served time in prison. It just, you can't trust what they came up with. Every single thing. It's like the movie Minority Report. If one is wrong, then they're all wrong. You know, you have to kind of treat it that way. And that's kind of how you got to view that, is that any investigation that took place during that time, You have to question it. You have to question on the merits of whether or not it was legitimate, how well it was investigated, if there was something that would make one of the deputies or the sheriff himself look bad in any way. It's pretty clear that they probably would bury that, it's hard to know.
Yeah, and I agree. And I also, one thing that bothers me about this whole case is that I think it was 10 men who mysteriously died during that time frame and were dumped. Nobody's looking into that. I mean,
right.
That's something that should be looked into. And also, another thing, are there any people who are in prison who were wrongfully convicted based on what they were doing? And is anybody looking into that? I don't know.
Yeah, it's clear that most of Parker's and his deputy's activities were relegated to pulling motorists over, and it's very, very unlikely that anybody got any, you know, prison time. If they did, it would of any length. However, I mentioned it in my notes, but during the investigation, during the trial, and after it was done, the assistant U.S. attorney, I think his name was Scott Woodward, he was quoted as saying that they had used waterboarding, which he didn't use that term, but that's what it was, during investigations, basically. And it was very clear from the wording that he used that he was not talking about people being pulled over, but he was talking about legitimate criminal investigations where they had used this form of torture. And there's actually a victim named in one of the articles that I saw. So while the motorist, yeah, very unlikely that there was anything, you know, related to serving time, there is definitely evidence, at least from the government side, for them to suggest that, yeah, there was some torture used during the course of investigations, which, as we, you know, common sense would indicate that people may have confessed to things that they didn't do and ended up serving time. But yeah, there nothing. I really only saw one or two articles that even really discussed that at all. So, yeah, I don't think anybody's looking into that. And it's, yeah, that's a big question mark, too. This is much bigger than, you know, David Wagner, and not to in any way downplay that, but there are a lot of people that were ensnared in this, you know, one way or the other. We just don't know if David was one of them.
Yeah, this case is a huge can of worms, and I would love for somebody to look into it even further.
And I think it's going to take the light of the media, and I know that Diane has had some conversations with, you know, sir, tried to push it to TV shows and that sort of thing. And to me, it's going to take something, you know, like Netflix is making of a murderer, you know, something like that, that's going to, you know, shine the light on this, that's going to spur movement, because that is pretty much the only way, it seems, to get, you know, people's attention, to get society's attention, is through the media, or, you know, some huge occurrence or event that happens that the media covers. But pretty much the media is the way to make that happen. So I would think it would have to be, you know, maybe someone hearing this podcast and deciding, you know, that is with one of those TV shows, or somebody from, you know, a higher up in some government, you know, law enforcement agency that hears it and decides, man, we need to look into this. I think that's about the only way that's going to happen.
If you have any information about the disappearance of David Wagoner, please call the Pasadena Police Department at 713-477-1221. That brings us to the end of episode 33. I would like to thank Diana for speaking with me, and also Phil for all of his help. Here is a short clip about History Personified.
I wanted to say thank you to Marissa and the Vanish Podcast audience for welcoming me into your world of true crime. I'm a true crime fan myself. Like I said, I'm a big fan of the show and other true crime shows. And my show is called History Personified. We're on iTunes and Google Play and podcast apps such as Overcast and Pocket Cast. And we drop new shows every Friday, and they're about history, which to me is a very broad term that covers a lot of subjects and topics. I mean, to me, yesterday is history. It can be a lot of different things. We've covered subjects such as Wyatt Earp, British sitcoms like Are You Being Served, Old West writers like Louis L'Amour, the Ronald Reagan assassination attempt. We've got a really interesting show with Clint Hill, who was a longtime Secret Service agent that was actually there the day that Kennedy was shot, and was the Secret Service agent that climbed into the car to protect Mrs. Kennedy. And I got to speak with him recently, and that'll be an upcoming episode. So we've got some really cool stuff, very wide ranging. So if you're into history at all, I hope that you will check us out. But I just want to say thank you for the opportunity to be on the show, and I hope you enjoyed it.
If you would like to connect with me on social media, I am on Twitter at The Vanished Pod. I have a Facebook page and a private discussion group. Just ask to join and someone will approve you. It is only private, so your comments do not show to all of your friends and family. There is a topic suggestion form on the website, and if you have a missing loved one that you would like to have featured on the show, please email me at thevanishedpodcast@gmail.com. If you like this show, there are several things that you can do to help me keep on improving each episode. First, subscribe on iTunes or anywhere that you listen to podcasts. Give The Vanished a positive review and share the show with your friends. Also, I would love to know a little bit more about you, so please complete a quick survey at wondery.com/survey. I promise you, it takes less than 3 minutes of your time. Again, that is wondery.com/survey. If you would like to contribute to the show to help defray some of my production expenses, please visit patreon.com/thevanishedpodcast. I would like to thank the listeners who have already done that. I truly appreciate it. I will catch up with you guys next week, and have a box of tissues ready when you listen. I am warning you, you will most likely need a few.
When David left, he had a little money left in the bank account. And not much, but he had money in the bank account. I still have his checks, and I have his dog tags and as much of him as I could, you know, keep.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
Welcome to the small town of Chinook, where faith runs deep and secrets run deeper. In this new thriller, available exclusively on Wondery Plus, religion and crime collide when a gruesome murder rocks the isolated Montana community. Everyone is quick to point their fingers at a drug-addicted teenager, but local deputy Ruth Vogel isn't convinced. She suspects connections to a powerful religious group. Enter federal agent V.B. Loureau, who has been investigating a local church for possible criminal activity. The pair form an unlikely partnership to catch the killer, unearthing secrets that leave Ruth torn between her duty to the law, her religious convictions, and her very own family. But something more sinister than murder is afoot, and someone is watching Ruth. With an all-star cast led by Emmy nominee Sanaa Lathan and Star Wars Kelly Marie Tran, Chinook is available exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.